proceed to our third argument of the afternoon. If the clerk will call the case, please.
The court will now call Michael Chappell versus the county commission. Faithful to the court, Mr. Brent Ordway will argue for the appellant. Ms. Andrea Simmons will argue for the state.
Mr. Ordway.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Like many sexual abuse cases, this was a he said, she said case, and it was about as clear an example of one imaginable. As the prosecutor argued at closing, there was one decision here. All you decide is, do you believe her or not? You just have to judge her credibility. All four grounds we raised on appeal have to go towards just that, the complainant's credibility. One and two with the hearsay, four with impeaching her stepmother's testimony, and the third ground having to do with attacking the complainant's motive, it all goes to her credibility. And I'd like to start off first addressing, I guess, some confusion or some issue there was about our harm argument as to the first, second, and fourth ground, that the admission of the hearsay testimony and the trial court's exclusion of impeachment evidence, that all that bolstered the complainant's testimony. Now, I recognize, Your Honor, that the Court of Criminal Appeals has said unequivocally that bolstering is not a proper objection on its own right, but I absolutely believe that it is a proper harm consideration. Bolstering at its core means that you're strengthening someone's testimony, and that's exactly what occurred in this case, and I believe that is an appropriate harm consideration. And I think that in the cases we've cited in our briefs, we've made clear that that remains an appropriate harm consideration. Moving to the grounds themselves, the first two grounds we addressed the trial court's admission of hearsay. I want to note that our second ground, dealing with the complainant's boyfriend's testimony, in which he really just straight relayed the complainant's allegations, the state doesn't dispute that that's hearsay, and I think for good reason. Now, the state does argue that it's not preserved because he gave details of the testimony immediately following and because the complainant herself then testified. As we brought up in our reply brief, though, Your Honors, the boyfriend's details came a page later in the record after the trial court explicitly...
What about the preservation aspect of your point on the boyfriend's testimony?
Well, that's what I'm attempting to address, Your Honor. Defense counsel objected, trial counsel overruled the objection, and then immediately thereafter, the boyfriend went into the details of her allegations. I understand that you have to object every time objectionable testimony comes in, but in this case, it's really one exchange. There's absolutely no reason to believe that the trial court would overrule an objection to the details and then affirm, or sustain an objection.
Support that position that you can go on for a page and a half in the record and you don't have to renew your objection?
Well, I believe I cited several cases on our reply brief that stand for the proposition that when it's futile to continue objecting, you don't have
to
do so.
Okay, you cited that 1986 case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, but we issued an opinion in 2010 in Gardner where we cited an intervening Court of Criminal Appeals case, Lede, where, if I'm reading it correctly, it sounded like the Court of Criminal Appeals said, Texas might be in a minority, but we do require objections every single time, and you really can't rely on just a futility argument.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would point to the Juarez case that I cited from Texarkana in 2015. I understand that is a different court. And I guess all I can really say to that is I think it's clear what the trial court's ruling was in this case. And to continue to request an objection one page later in the record, a span of, I don't know, 30 seconds, would have been futile. And so...
One overruling makes any further objection futile?
No, absolutely not. I'm not saying that at all. But when we're talking about the span of 30 seconds or a minute, I do think that's different than saying, the next volume of the record, the next day at trial.
But shouldn't you at least, you might think it's futile, but perhaps asking for some sort of running objection?
I wouldn't argue that trial counsel's, what he did here was ideal, but I think that it was enough to preserve it for this court's review, especially, you know, from my perspective, in light of how obvious this hearsay was. I feel that he made it clear what his objection was. The trial court overruled it. I think this court should address that ground. In addition, the state also raised or argued that the girl's testimony rendered it unpreserved. I think that is incorrect too. For the case I cited in my reply brief, Matz from the Court of Criminal Appeals, these are two completely different forms of evidence, the boyfriend's hearsay testimony and the girlfriend's testimony. They're not subject to the same objection, and I do not believe that renders it unpreserved. Moving to the complainant's father's testimony relaying her phone call, the state's point in its brief that she was describing how she felt is well taken, but she also was describing why she felt that way. Because of what her father had done to her, because of what her stepfather had done to her. And I think under the law that the state cited, under the law that we've cited, it's clear that once you cross that line, it does become an admissible hearsay. Really, I think the only thing to argue about here is whether or not the implication was clear. I'll note again that the state did not dispute that it's plain what the statement was referring to. And I would just reassert that there's really no other conclusion. We know what she was talking about. Yeah,
remind me, was that conversation that the dad overheard, was that as long as 3 years after this abuse ended? Remind me the timeline.
I believe this was all occurring around 2014, right, around the time that it was reported. And then the trial was in 2016, so...
No, but I mean, as far as when the abuse... That was 2011?
Right.
When the defendant...
Yes. That was 2011. The reporting was in the spring of 2014, and then the trial was in the spring of 2016, I believe.
Okay, and Dad overheard this conversation in the shed?
Right.
In what year?
It was years later. I mean, my understanding was around 2014. I mean, all these allegations came to a head in the spring of 2014. Before then, there was no outcry. And then just to get to the harm of these grounds, again, it all goes back to this idea of bolstering the complainant's testimony. You have a complainant who's testifying at trial in 2016, and the state is able, through inadmissible hearsay, to introduce that these allegations have remained consistent for several years, in effect bolstering her testimony, and it is our contention that that is the harm that affected Mr. Chappell's substantial rights.
Prior consistent statements, however, aren't they admissible if motive is at issue?
Well, if I'm sorry, I don't
bolstering
really...
Bolstering is basically a prior consistent statement.
Right.
And doesn't the rule say that prior consistent statements are admissible, they're an exception to the hearsay rule, when motive is called into question? Motive, recent fabrication, there's a list of them, but motive is one of them. And wasn't motive at issue in this case?
Well, I suppose the complainant's motive certainly was at issue. I mean, the defense at trial was that she was falsely accusing him so she could live with her father. But I don't think that those prior consistent statements would allow the hearsay testimony of her boyfriend and her father.
I was actually talking about the father.
Well, I don't know. To be honest with you, Your Honor, I haven't considered that really too deeply. The argument, I haven't considered it really. But, I would again argue that certainly the complainant's boyfriend's testimony was inadmissible. I mean, that was... He went kind of line by line through the allegations. Moving to the third ground, which had to deal with this photograph of the complainant's brother, I believe it was, and then his girlfriend, who's also her best friend, kissing at the father's house. So the trial court held that this was not relevant. Again, I'll note that the state does not dispute that this was relevant, but the state argues this can't come in through mom.
Well, and didn't trial counsel, in fact, say that the photo would be offered through another witness and then it wasn't?
Yes, that's right. He did not offer it through another witness. I'm sure he...
Do you think it would have been proper to have admitted it through the mother?
I do think it would have been proper to admit it through the mother. For just the reason that I cited in those cases in my reply brief, she clearly knew who the subjects were in the photo. She talked with the stepmother about it. I don't think there was any questions that she was able to properly identify and authenticate the photo. And I would just kind of point the court to the cases that I've cited in my reply brief that I think address similar cases where the courts have held that you don't have to know where or when a photo was taken.
I guess explain to me why that's not a really tenuous piece of evidence to support the notion that life was much freer for the complainant, that the defendant was saying had a motive to make this story up in order to be able to live with her father and stepmother instead. I mean, what did this photograph of her brother kissing somebody, how did that, I mean, to me it just seems really tenuous.
Well, I'm not going to argue that this was, you know, the defense's silver bullet. It wasn't going to guarantee a not guilty verdict, but it does, I think, show that they didn't run as strict of a household. I mean, you have these young kids. I mean, they were in their early teens, I believe, who are in this house apparently unsupervised kissing. I think that that does demonstrate that this was not the strictest home.
Okay, I'm not going to think about my own teenage years, but I'm just not. Never mind. Sorry.
So, in other words, mom didn't allow kissing in the house, and dad did allow kissing in the house.
Well, and
what it would tend to prove or not prove.
Yes, and I think that that goes to whether or not the level of supervision in the home. And I think that, you know, remembering from our own teenage years, as a teenager, you want to be in a home that's less supervised. So.
But unless the mother was there taking the picture and going smile for the camera, I just don't see how. I think in a lot of strict households, people find a way around the strictness. But
well, you know, again, I'm not saying that this was a silver bullet. I just think that it tends to show some sort of disparity in the level of strictness in the two homes.
But you were still allowed to present that defense, that there was this motive of hers to fabricate this charge so that she could go live with her dad, even without the photograph, correct?
Yes, absolutely. There was definitely testimony that that conveyed that idea. We're just saying that the photograph was the best possible or better evidence of that idea, more evocative. Seeing this actual photograph of it is more convincing to a jury than hearing testimony from, you know, these people who maybe not credible.
But you have to weigh the probative value versus the prejudicial effect. And the son, we don't know whether parents were there, whether parents weren't there. Was this a selfie? Was this taken by a friend? Was it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when everybody was at work? Without knowing any of the circumstances surrounding the photograph, couldn't the judge weigh the probative value versus the prejudicial effect and decide without abusing discretion that it shouldn't be admitted?
Well, but all those things that you just listed don't change the fact that, I mean, this occurred in that home. And so one way or another, this was allowed to happen in the complainant's mother's
we
home.
We don't know if it was...
My years as a parent, yeah, and think, yeah, if everything, yeah, that, yeah, occurred in my home...
Yes, yes, it might have, okay, happened, but that doesn't mean that it was allowed.
Okay.
But anyway.
That's right.
It also doesn't mean that it didn't occur in the other home, because there's not a picture in the other home. I'm having a hard time seeing that it actually provides a benchmark of comparison.
Well, I don't think that trial counsel had to prove that it didn't occur in the other home for this to be admissible. I mean, he was showing that this kind of thing was allowed to happen in the complainant's mother's house. Nothing more, nothing less. He was, I mean, I don't see.
In the father's house.
Yes, in the father's house. Sorry, I can get confused.
That children were allowed to kiss in the father's house.
Yes.
Before your time's up, I have a question about your fourth point. on the stepmother's prior convictions. If this case boils down to the he said, she said, which is your argument, how would showing that the stepmother had been convicted of prostitution do anything to affect the complainant's credibility one way or another?
Well, Your Honor, the complainant's stepmother is the outcry witness. So she is relaying a statement that the complainant gave some 2 years before trial, which again, that statement demonstrates the complainant's consistency. So yes, there's certainly kind of a step removed from that by talking about the stepmother, but the stepmother is relaying this statement that bolsters the complainant's credibility. So I think that makes the stepmother the relayer of that statement, her credibility at issue,
too. It might be different if the complainant didn't testify, but she testified herself, so.
Well, it would certainly be more important if the complainant didn't testify, but I don't think that it's unimportant. If there are no more questions, I guess that's my time.
May it please the court, counsel. I would like to start this afternoon by discussing the preservation issue as to the victim's boyfriend, J.W. The state would just like to re-urge that we do believe that that issue was not preserved. There wasn't an objection, and I do understand opposing counsel's argument as to when an objection has become futile, and I think that the answer to futile objections is the request for a running objection. And so the state would rely on that as far as responding to the preservation issue. As to the photograph at issue, there was some confusion between briefs made by me and appellant's attorney regarding authentication by a statement that the undersigned myself made regarding there was no evidence as to when the picture was taken. Not necessarily discussing authentication. I understand that the photograph could properly be authenticated by the mother as identifying the persons in the photograph. However, when it goes to the actual relevance of the photograph, of when was this picture taken, who was present when the picture was taken, things of that nature, although also relate to authentication, specifically and factually related to this case on how it was going to be relevant or not. As many of you said, Justice Kerr and Justice Gabriel, there was no evidence by the introduction of that picture that the father of the victim was aware of what these kids were doing in the home, and the photograph in no way was going to be relevant in proving that his home was a less strict home than the mother's. And in addition to that, if there were any error, there was so much other evidence allowed to be introduced by the defense regarding their defensive theory. They were not precluded from offering that or raising a defense. In fact, they questioned every witness in detail regarding both parents' homes and what mom allowed them to do and what dad allowed them to do to try to get the jury to infer their motive, their defensive motive in this case. Even if the court were to find that the photograph the trial court's ruling on the photograph was inadmissible or was error, the next argument would be constitutional harm, non-constitutional harm, and under 44.2B, you would have to find that the photograph, the exclusion of that, took away from his core vital of his defense or precluded him from offering a defense. And admittedly, Pella has stated this afternoon that that was not their silver bullet, and that was not going to prove their defense one way or the other. It would, and they just thought it was going to help their defense, but it was not going to prevent them from going forward with their defense. As to the previous convictions of the stepmother, the state would stand by my brief on that issue. The prior convictions were very remote. They had nothing to do with the testimony of this case.
Do you think that for them to have fallen within the, I guess, exception, for lack of a better word, if she was continuing to do to run afoul of the law. Do you see a distinction legally between the fact that she hadn't been convicted of anything else within the last decade, but she was on deferred adjudication, which basically admitted that she was violating the law still?
I believe that when you look at that, that the case law, the rule at hand states when there are subsequent convictions.
So you don't think deferred adjudication counts?
I would argue that it did not count because by her successfully completing that adjudication and having the case subsequently dismissed, I think that she proved, although she had run afoul of the law, she was able to rehabilitate herself again in that moment, and which was why it did not result in a final conviction. And Justice Kerr also would agree with you, as you were saying earlier, I'm not sure how any of these prior convictions had appellant been allowed to question the stepmother as to those, how those affected her testimony in this case or the credibility of the victim in this case. I just don't think that it was relevant to begin with. And so we would argue that the trial court did not err in excluding evidence of those prior convictions.
Well, let me ask you about the father's testimony of overhearing the complainant's phone conversation in the shed. This was obviously long after the incidents occurred. So the state was introducing that to show her current state of mind years after the fact, or was it really, I mean, really to show the content of what the father overheard rather than her current mental state?
I think that by the father, they kind of go hand in hand. If the father is testifying to what he overheard, what he's overheard is relating to her state of mind, showing that kind of in response to the defensive, that she's making all of this up, that so that she can live in a less lenient or more lenient home. Here she is when she doesn't think she's being watched, talking on the phone and talking about how upset and mad she is at appellant and her mother. And I think that that goes to support her theory, her allegations, as well as addressing the...
Well, now, that would be one thing if the father just said, I heard her talking and she was super upset.
Right.
But do you see any hearsay problems with the fact that he was then also allowed to say, and she said appellant had done X, Y, and Z?
I do think that the majority of the law out there, when I first started looking at it, is that you can have the mental condition or the state of mind, and then there's, which is okay and admissible, but on the other hand, then you cannot go into the facts beyond that to prove what caused the emotion or the
right
state of mind.
Right. So why did that, the admission of that testimony, not, as defense counsel suggests or appellant's counsel suggest, bolster or just create this totality of evidence so that it took it beyond the realm of just he said, she said?
Well, first, I would mention that I did note Martinez in my brief, and the case that I looked at on Martinez wasn't exactly on point as far as it was going, but it did indicate how you separate the one and the two, finding one admissible and whether or not the other one is. And it relied on part of the evidence was not being offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. I think that's kind of circular because if you go back to the cases that support not going into the vents to support it, I think it's kind of circular. But the only reason I did note that case, and there are also a couple of other opinions out there who kind of bypass that second prong, and it was just a note that they did exist. However, I think that if it was error on that second prong of her statement that she's upset and mad is okay, but because of what appellant had done, I think arguably that runs afoul of the case law.
Yeah, and really, why else would the state have wanted to put that evidence on?
But, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as far as why they wanted to put it on, I mean, at that point, I'd be inferring with the trial why they put it on. Otherwise, I'm just kind of speculating. Like I said before, though, I think it does go into effect of showing that when she was talking to either friends or a boyfriend on the telephone, that she's
upset.
She's being consistent with her statements of the allegations, and there's no indicia that she's making up these allegations to get into a more lenient home.
Doesn't that go to what Justice Sutterth was asking about, and that is that once motive is raised as a defense, then you can put on prior consistent statement, and her statement wasn't, I'm mad at my mom and I'm mad at my stepdad because I got caught trying to be, you know, get moved to a more lenient home. It's I'm mad at him because of what happened. So that's a prior consistent statement that goes to refute the defense that was raised that puts the issue of motive into play.
I think both you and Justice Sutterth are both correct on that, and I failed to address that or raise that or find it in my brief, but I was listening to Justice Sutterth's comment or question to opposing counsel and thought that's the aha moment you wish you had grasped it earlier. But I would agree that that is directly what I'm trying to argue now, is if we're going to speculate as to why the trial prosecutors asked the questions to begin with, I think that that is where they were probably going with that.
So do you think that if you know that the defense is going to be, I don't know, I want to get out of a strict household or whatever the defense is, do you think then that it's all right for the state to put on that any hearsay evidence would become admissible if it is consistent with the state's view of the case and goes against that motive?
I don't think, as far as if it goes against that, the state's case, I don't think that it would be admissible just based upon that. But I think if it is a prior consistent statement and it's supporting that and it's going directly to the motive or the bias that they're alleging, I think that it would overcome the hearsay objection. And specifically in this case, from this first witness, the appellant began questioning people as to what was allowed in the father's home, which obviously let everyone know what their defense was from the beginning of this case. And so although that was not something that I argued in my brief, I would concede that Justice Sutterth, that was a very good question, and I do believe that the Justice Gabriel, you also brought it up, that the prior consistent statement was probably the proper response to this issue, which I failed to raise. And if the court has no further questions, the state would just rely on its brief and ask that the trial court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ordaway?
Just briefly, Your Honors, kind of as Justice Kerr touched upon, I think that if in this case we say this testimony was admissible as a prior consistent statement, we're in effect creating a new exception to the hearsay rule.
It's actually defined as not hearsay. I looked it up. It's not even hearsay to begin with. A statement that meets the following conditions is not hearsay. The declarant testifies, and it's a prior statement consistent with the declarant's testimony offered to rebut an express or implied charge that the declarant acted from improper motive.
Well, all I can say is that this sort of testimony is going to be admissible in every sexual abuse case. I mean, every sexual abuse case, the defense is that this is a false accusation. So
false accusation is not an improper motive. Improper motive is she's doing it, she's lying, not just that they're lying. They're lying because of this. It's an improper motive.
But there's always a reason for the false accusation.
A lot of times it's just a, yes, I did, no, I didn't. Yes, he did, no, I didn't, period.
Okay. I would then just like to touch on the fourth ground again.
I think that you might have a confrontation problem, but that's not what was raised here. As far as hearsay is concerned, which is what was raised here, I think it doesn't fall within hearsay.
I understand, Your Honor. Just to the complainant's stepmother's convictions, I just wanted to bring up, yes, the completion of the deferred adjudication shows that she hasn't run afoul of the law since the time in which she pleaded guilty to running afoul of the law. But the fact that she was on deferred adjudication means that she pleaded guilty or no contest to committing some offense. I think that it's clear then that she has run afoul of the law. and that the fact that she committed or that she completed deferred adjudication after the fact does not change that. I have nothing else, Your Honor. I would ask that you reverse Mr. Chappell's convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming to Fort Worth, and your case is submitted. We very much appreciate you being here today. You are excused, and this is our last argument, so we will adjourn court for the day.